You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation here at the Brookings Institution. And I'd like to welcome you to our forum on mobile technology's role in combating global poverty. And we are webcasting this event live, so we'd like to offer a warm welcome to our viewers from around the country as well as around the world. In addition, we will be archiving today's video, so anyone who wishes to view this after today will have an opportunity to do so through the Brookings website. That's at brookings.edu. And for both our live as well as our virtual audience, we've set up a live Twitter feed at hashtag TechCTI. That's TechCTI, so feel free to post comments and or ask questions during the forum. And during the Q&A segment, we will take questions both from our live as well as virtual audiences. According to a recent World Bank study, nearly one quarter of the global population lives at or below the poverty level of $1.25 a day. The world's poorest experience barriers to economic gain due to corruption, poor infrastructure, and lack of access to capital to start small businesses. But the growth of mobile technology has paved the way for improved economic circumstances. It enables monetary transfers, greater access to microfinance loans, and small business development. Today, we are putting out a paper entitled Alleviating Poverty. I hope you were able to pick up a copy on the way in. If not, you can get one on the way out. It's outside in the hallway outside the auditorium. And the paper looks at ways mobile communications can help fight global poverty. In it, I identify the barriers to economic growth in developing countries and ways in which mobile devices can improve the possibilities for business in the developing world. In particular, I argue that mobile technology helps fight poverty by expediting mobile payment services, money transfers, and microfinance loans. But at the same time, there remain many barriers in various countries around the world to taking advantage of these things, so we need to think about ways to overcome those types of obstacles. This event is part of our mobile economy project, and we appreciate the support that Qualcomm has provided for this entire project. This is a three-year effort to understand how mobile communications is transforming many aspects of education, healthcare, and economic development. This afternoon, we are joined by a number of distinguished guests, some of whom came from great distances in order to be with us. Jenny Aker is an assistant professor of economics at the Fletcher School and the Department of Economics at Tufts University. She is also a non-resident fellow at the Center for Global Development, a member of the advisory board for Frontline SMS, and the Boston Network for International Development. She also serves as deputy director of the Hitachi Center for Technology and International Affairs. She concentrates on economic development in Africa and has done extensive field work in that region, and her primary focus is on the impact of information and information technology on development outcomes. Nancy Lee is the general manager of the Multilateral Investment Fund at the Inter-American Development Bank. She has served at the bank for 2 years. Prior to that, she was deputy assistant secretary for the Western Hemisphere at the U.S. Treasury Department and helped manage Treasury's engagement in economic and financial issues in Latin America, the Caribbean, and Canada. And while at Treasury, she served in a number of other roles, including Director of the Office of Central and Eastern Europe, Director of the Office of the Middle East and Central Asia, and Deputy Director of the Office of Asian and Near East Nations, which means you really got around the world there, I can tell from your portfolios. Carlos Pierre is Portfolio Manager for Kiva's Strategic Initiatives Fund, and he's based in San Francisco. He helped push Kiva's model to go beyond microfinance institutions to work with universities, agricultural co-ops, solar power distributors, fair trade companies, and other types of social enterprises that benefit from the use of credit. He graduated from Brown University with a degree in development and has studied in China, Mexico, and Japan. He pushes social change via market mechanisms and wants to help bridge the financing gaps faced by social enterprises. Abhishek Sinha is co-founder and CEO of Echo India Financial Services. He began his career with Satyam Computers and worked for their telecom division. In 2002, he co-founded 60 Telecom Solutions, and he grew this business to span 9 different countries and 15 operators, and he's helped to implement a number of e-commerce products in the business. He started Echo with a vision to promote mobile phones as a financial identity tool for people at the bottom of the pyramid. So I'd like to start with Jenny. So you've written extensively on economic development in Africa. How is mobile influencing efforts against global poverty? And what is it that mobile devices can do and what can't they do?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think most of us are here because we're interested in the potential for mobile phones to reduce poverty in low-income countries, and for pretty good reason. You know, as Daryl mentioned, in 1999, about 10% of the population of sub-Saharan Africa had access to mobile phone coverage. By 2012, that was over 70% of the population. And it's not just this growth in coverage. There's also been a growth in kind of mobile phone adoption and usage, from 16 million subscribers back in 2000 to about 350 million subscribers in sub-Saharan Africa today. And that's about 30% of the population. And so what that implies is that kind of poor consumers in some of the poorest countries in the world are actually adopting and using mobile phones, in many cases in places where they haven't had access to other traditional infrastructure like power, roads, and landlines. And so, you know, obviously this growth of mobile phone coverage and adoption has gotten a lot of us really excited about what mobile phones can do. You know, Paul Kagame has talked about this, The Economist magazine, Jeffrey Sachs, and I think that this is for pretty good reason. We should be very, very excited. But a question I'd like us to have in our mind is, you know, number one, is mobile phones or are mobile phones really kind of helping the world's poor? And number two, what can mobile phones do? What can't they do? And what do and don't we know about actually their impact on well-being of the world's poor? And so I'd like to just maybe start off with a really brief framework and think about what a mobile phone can do. So if you have a simple mobile phone, not the iPhone that most of us have, which is what most people in poor countries are using, they can do three things: communication device, transfer device, and savings device. So in terms of communication, it reduced the cost of communicating information over long distances, especially compared to landlines. Landline penetration is very low. That's nice because now you can call up members of your friends and your family, which is really important when they're basically your insurance network. You can look around for price and labor and health market information, which is extremely important when previously you actually had to physically travel to these areas. You can use it as an educational device. You can get SMS reminders about your election, about savings, a whole bunch of different things. Now, from the transfer perspective that Daryl talked about a little bit, we know that with mobile money and its precursor airtime, people now with mobile phones are able to kind of send and receive transfers much more efficiently, much at a much lower cost. And what this means is that you're able to get access to money when and where you actually need it, as compared with the bus or Western Union or MoneyGram. And as a savings device, we could just think about kind of the handset itself as offering potentially a much more secure place to save. If you have a PIN number that no one else can access, as compared with putting it under your mattress, it might also allow you to kind of have greater access to your money rather than kind of waiting for your savings group. And so the nice thing is that we have these three potential outcomes, these three potential uses, and we have a little bit of evidence, at least from a qualitative and a quantitative perspective, about whether or not they're helping people. So work I've done in Niger and other people have done in India suggests that mobile phones are actually allowing kind of price dispersion across markets to be reduced. They're making these agricultural markets more efficient. There's work that's been done in India and Uganda that say that farmers with access to mobile phones are actually getting better prices for their crops. On the transfer side, there's been work that's been done in Rwanda and in Kenya that suggests that those who have access to mobile money are able to receive transfers after a shock. And then there's some anecdotal evidence that people are actually saving on your mobile phone. So there's a lot of kind of suggestive evidence, both qualitative and quantitative, that suggests that mobile phones really are working to help kind of the well-being of the world's poor. But as we're kind of talking about this today, I'd like us maybe to think about four things. And the first thing is that I think these studies are really promising. I just mentioned a fraction of them, but they're really dependent upon the specific countries and contexts. And I would argue that they're a fraction of what we can and should know about the impact of mobile phones. Second of all, when we're thinking about kind of the reduction in communication and transfer costs, they can make these markets more efficient. But efficiency doesn't say anything about equity. So there's going to be winners and losers. And just because an agricultural market in Niger is functioning more efficiently, it doesn't necessarily mean that the farmer is the one who's going to get the higher price at the end of the day. Third of all, if you go back to kind of the uses of mobile phones about communication, transfer, and savings, when we're using mobile phones, we have to think about the fact that they're going to kind of help development problems that are associated to one of those three things. And so in many cases, if you're a farmer and you get access to price information, you know where that higher price is, but there's no road that connects you actually to that market, or you get to that market and there's only one trader, then transferring that information into getting a higher price, it's not going to happen. And then finally, I'd like us to think a little bit about kind of the fact that mobile phones, both the handset and the applications that are on it, it's a hardware, but it's also a software. And so what do I mean by that? We often might have the assumption that if we build it, they will come. And what I mean is that, you know, we have about over 80 mobile money programs worldwide. Adoption outside of a few countries is extremely low for a variety of reasons. I'm not going to go into that because I think Nancy's going to go into that. But we have to be thinking about the fact that technology in and of itself is not necessarily going to improve development. It's the interaction of that technology with other socio-demographic factors. So when we're building our applications, when we're building our platforms, we want to be thinking about, number one, what does the client need? What are they actually getting out of kind of this service? Number two, is it something they can get access to via a simple mobile phone device, at least right now, on the local market? Third, if they get access to it, do they know how to use it, or could they be trained in how to use it? And this is especially relevant for illiterate populations, which is going to be kind of a very important problem in many cases in sub-Saharan Africa. And finally, how does that technology really interact with the larger enabling environment? So in short, I think that there's a lot of potential. That's great. But I'd also like us to think about that with a little bit of caution as well. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. So, Nancy, you focus on Latin America. Jenny pointed out some of the opportunities, but you mentioned in our pre-briefing that Latin America has been a little slower than other regions in taking advantage of these. So what are the challenges that need to be overcome? What are some of the exciting experiments that you see taking place?
Thanks so much. You know, Latin America has a relatively well-developed capital market. Relatively well-developed banks, well-regulated banks, but they do not extend access to financial services to large shares of the population. It has a it has very good mobile phone penetration, over 100% mobile phone penetration, so higher than Africa. So you'd think with the combination of need for more access, high mobile phone penetration, and a banking sector that isn't really getting to the base of the pyramid, there should be kind of scope for a revolution in the provision of financial services through mobile technology. It is on the verge, but it is not happening yet. So what I wanted to do is just briefly tell you what the current situation is, go over some of the challenges that are preventing you know, this kind of massive expansion and scale in those experiments, and then talk about what we and some others are doing to jumpstart progress. Okay, so first on the access side, still in a region, middle-income region with a well-developed banking sector, 25% of low-income adults, only 25% have an account at a formal financial institution. Only 9.5% of the LAC population saved at a formal financial institution in the past year. Interestingly, Latin America and the Caribbean has the lowest proportion of bank branches per square kilometer of any region in the world, lower actually than Africa. So you can see part of the reason that the banking sector is not reaching these populations. The cost of financial transactions remains quite high. Here's a sort of very telling statistic. For the lowest income quintile in Latin America and the Caribbean, the cost of opening an account represents more than 30% of annual average income. And the reason for that is the minimum balance requirements are so high that for a lowest income household, it is simply prohibitively expensive to open an account. Now, just comparing the usage of mobile accounts for financial transactions in Africa and in sub-Saharan Africa and in Latin America. The percentage of adults in Latin America who used a mobile phone to pay bills within the last 12 months, this is FinDex World Bank data, was 1.8% for Latin America, 3% in sub-Saharan Africa. The percentage of adults in Latin America who used a mobile phone to receive money within the past 12 months, 1.8%, compared to 14.5% in sub-Saharan Africa. So we have really a lot of unexploited potential with respect to using these mobile platforms. And at the same time, you have huge flows which could be channeled to these populations and to providing financial services to these populations using mobile phones as the channel. For example, 27 million low-income women receive global social protection payments like conditional cash transfers in the region. 60 billion in remittance flows into the region to 20 million households. So this is a flow which generates really exactly what you need in order to create scale in financial services models and use of mobile technology. So what are some of the issues? What I want to do is talk about the supply side first and then the demand side, because there really are challenges on both sides. I think from our experience, we would say that the single biggest problem on the supply side is actually finding a business model that works commercially. That is, in which the value chain is divided amongst all the actors in a commercially viable way. So these are small transactions, a lot of small transactions. So the profit margins are very low. And at the same time, there's a lot of actors. There are banks, there are mobile service providers, there are the payment networks, there are the agent banks, or the bank agents. So you have to find a way to take these narrow profit margins and divide them across all of these actors. And that is the problem that really we're struggling with, I would say, the most in the experiments we're trying to support around the region. Second issue is, and Jenny alluded to this, it's not a trivial matter to find a product that is actually useful and low cost for the client. It has to be a low cost product, but it also has to be useful. They have to be able to get to it. They have to be able to use it. And they have to have confidence that intermediating their cash is actually going to create value for them. Third, you have to reach a critical mass of recurrent transactions. That is, it's not enough just to have people open accounts. They have to use the accounts, because if they don't use the accounts, there will not be enough value generated to share across these multiple actors. Fourth, you have to develop an ecosystem for cash in and cash out. That is, there's got to be enough points of cash in and cash out so that people have confidence that they can actually cash out their money and that they have a place to go to put their money in at the start of the transaction system. Interoperability is a big issue in places where there are multiple mobile service providers. In Kenya, there was not initially, and so in a way that really helped the experiment take off. And then the regulatory issues are very complex, and I would say that's another challenge that this region in particular is dealing with, because this is a region with strong regulation based on multiple financial crises. Bank regulators in this region are serious and want to make sure that they don't allow unnecessary risks to build up in the system. So you have to balance financial inclusion with financial stability. You have to regulate multiple actors, again, you know, like five different sets of actors. There are different service provision models. You can have an account on a mobile phone with a bank account linked to it or without a bank account linked to it. There's the consumer protection issues. The regulator has to decide whether to try to support competition among mobile providers. And then, you know, something that we've been trying to focus on is data collection. So that's all the supply side. Then there's the demand side. There are financial literacy issues, and we're increasingly convinced, based on our experience, that again, it's not an if you build it, they will come. You have to really educate people to know how to use these products and know what these products are for, and know what kinds of products work for them. A lot of our region has a preference for cash. That's not unusual in the developing world.
Actually, I have a preference for cash myself too.
Yeah, you need to try to get over that. And then there's a sort of a moving target problem, which is, people are moving from basic phones to smartphones. So if you're a provider and you're trying to create a product, you're sort of in between now whether you should be doing it for a basic phone or a smartphone. So what's happening in the region? Let me be brief. We count 40 inclusive mobile financial services initiative in Latin America, which sounds like it's half of the world, according to what Jenny says. But that may be just because we're kind of behind and we need to catch up. There are a lot of interesting experiments, which I can talk about if people are interested. We, in particular, are supporting a number of experiments in the Multilateral Investment Fund. And here are the ones that are of most interest to us. Ones that provide savings as well as payments capacity. Ones that include multiple financial institutions so that multiple banks can use the platform. One in which multiple mobile service providers can use the platform. Ones that are driven by regular flows to households, like remittances or conditional cash transfers. And ones that even involve the capacity to use your mobile phone to pay for public services. So not only receive the transfer, but actually to pay for public services, which is another powerful driver of demand for the products. So, and these are happening all over the region. Some of the most interesting are in Paraguay, in Colombia, in Mexico, and in Haiti. So what we're trying to do is basically help support these programs by providing grants and other support to take some of the risk and to bear some of the costs. And then, we're very focused on gathering together the knowledge we get from these experiments and sharing it within our own region and outside our region. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. So, Carlos, Kiva uses microfinance and other kinds of institutions to improve economic development. What are the activities that you view as most promising right now?
Okay. Microfinance. Let's put some context into it. It starts from the assumption that individuals will be able to lift themselves out of poverty if they're given access to financial services. The mobile platform, 2.6 million people do not have access to financial services. About 1 billion of them have access to mobile phones. And this is creating a very interesting platform in which the world of microfinance and the world of international development can build upon. Some examples that embody this are some of the partners that Kiva has been working with. Most of you might relate to Kiva as a lender through a crowdfunding website that lends through microfinance institutions. Recently, we have started to expand to non-microfinance institutions. This includes agricultural co-ops, universities, NGOs, and any type of social business that can use capital to improve its business, to have a greater social impact. So one example of these partners that are using mobile technology is in Uganda. It focuses primarily on farmers, and it provides them with information. So if you're a farmer and your chicken is sick, or if your pig gets sick, or if something is happening to your crops, you might not know what it is, and nobody in your community knows. What the Grameen App Lab is doing is providing community knowledge workers with mobile phones that have a database of all the types of diseases that are prevalent in that region and local solutions that use local ingredients in order for farmers to address these. The underlying purpose of this is to increase farmer productivity. What Kiva is doing is financing these handheld devices, the scales and other equipment, for example, a solar panel and the battery to charge the solar phone so that you can use it in the middle of nowhere, or at least get on top of the mountain so you can get signal and then go back down to the middle of nowhere and continue your work to provide and increase the productivity of farmers. Another example would be with shopkeepers in Mexico. This is particularly in Mexico City. The company name is FrogTech, and what they do is that they provide shopkeepers with inventory management tools. This is, again, on through a mobile device. And what you have to remember is that small shopkeepers have about 1,000 products in their shop. They're working around with 25 vendors, and they're keeping track of all these products through pen and paper. So if you ask them, what's your most profitable project? What is the one that's going to expire next? They have no idea. Or some do, and they actually, like, after the end of the of their day, they go into their computer and try to keep this information in the most, like, this is the best you can expect from, like, the most, like, cutting-edge shopkeeper in Mexico will have a computer and is trying to keep a good tab of what he's doing. What FrogTech is doing is providing these shopkeepers with a barcode reader that can actually keep track of all their products. Some products that do not have barcodes, FrogTech also creates custom-made barcodes so that you can keep tab of your own products. Again, this incredibly helps inventory management for shopkeepers. It's bringing 21st century technology to these mom-and-pop shops. Finally, another example is in Indonesia with a company called PT Rumah. This is for entrepreneurs who want to increase their business. They can get a loan from Kiva to get equipment that allows them to pay bills online. Not online, pay bills mobily, remotely. So the users in their community are able to pay their electricity bills, their water bills, their credit cards, their motorcycle bills through mobile payments. And this increases their business because more people have a reason to stop by in their shop. And my final example is in regards to Kiva itself. We have a new pilot called Kiva Zip, and it's basically focused in the U.S. and in Kenya. And it's lending directly through, so it's without our field partners, without our intermediary, but lending directly to individuals. This causes lots of problems, primarily. I mean, it sounds super cool that you can lend directly to one individual, but the challenge is, how do you know that that individual will be able to pay you back? And when we had field partners, or as when we usually, in our basic model, we have field partners that intermediate and do a credit analysis and check that that person is credit worthy. And we have to, like, bootstrap that own model and create new processes by which we can identify which individuals are credit worthy and which ones are not. In this way, Kiva is continuing to experiment. What we've come to realize, or what you should probably be aware of, is, I mean, the money is out there. There's a lot of money out there, but it can't reach small enterprises, small social businesses, because the risks are unclear. And if you're coming from a risk-return paradigm, if you do not know the risks, you do not know what return you need to demand. So it was very common to go to a conference and find a lot of social entrepreneurs who are trying to reach impact investors, and there's this gap in the discourse because social entrepreneurs are not trying to get 20% returns, but impact investors need that return to justify the risk. What Kiva is proposing is a risk-tolerant capital that will be able to help social and businesses prove that model, quantify those risks, so that they can then go graduate to other types of impact and pool commercial capital.
Okay, thank you. Abhishek, you co-founded Echo India and have done tremendous work to alleviate poverty. Could you describe how your economic development activities are taking place in India and what kind of results you're seeing?
Sure, thanks, Daryl. Echo is about 5 years old, and some very exciting things were unfolding in front of us. One was the sheer penetration of cell phones and the amazing ways cell phone was being used by people. And you could see, even in urban locations, you could see that cell phone was evolving as an identity. So you would have on walls, you would have the cell phone number painted, and below that you would have the name of the service. So plumbing, electrician, pesticides, kind of mentioned. And it is prevalent even today. So, and a lot of such things were happening both in urban and rural locations. So what we could see is that people were evolving the cell phone as their identity, and it was driving economic activity for these individuals. And also what was very exciting to see how cell phone was being used, because India is a country where you have multiple languages and very diverse languages. You have issues of literacy. And numbers, or rather missed calls, was evolving as a language of its own. And there is no concept of voicemail in India. People, if by default they have a voicemail, they will never check it.
This is good to know, by the way. So.
and it's all about missed calls. And you know that that a certain call was a missed call to communicate a message, or do I need to return the call back? And especially for people who are low-income, moderate-income individuals, most of them subscribe to prepaid plans. And to save on cost, they have evolved this missed call language. So a couple of if the call desk gets disconnected after one ring, it means something after two rings, something else. And you would always see, say for example, I have a driver. He will call and disconnect because he knows that he need not pay. I'm his boss. I'm going to call back and get the details. So numbers, missed calls, the way people were using it to drive their economic activity, this was very, very fascinating. And mobile network operators had evolved. So you could walk into a mom-and-pop store and load your phone with more talk time. And this was happening as an electronic transaction. There were no coupons, nothing. So all of this was very exciting for us to see and to say, why can't banking happen exactly the way, SIM cards are being sourced, so the customers fill their forms for SIM cards. The same you do for bank accounts. Why can't it happen at the same outlet or similar outlets? The way cash-in is going in and talk time is coming out, why can't we have cash-in to convert money into electronic money? And all of this was so inspirational that we started Echo, and today, across 2,500 outlets, you can walk into these outlets and open a bank account for yourself. And these are bank accounts which have deposit insurance. These are bank accounts which are interest-bearing accounts. These mom-and-pop stores, with the help of a cell phone, get converted into human ATMs, so you can do cash-in, cash-out transactions. And for us, the biggest design challenge was that how do we make sure that our syntax is same across every cell phone? And this was, so it had to work on every cell phone. It had to work across languages. So what we had seen was numbers. And today we have Echo is probably the only company globally which does secure financial transactions on a cell phone without having to install any app on the phone or the SIM card. And it's all about dialing of numbers. So that's what we do. And we cater to close to about 3 million customers and transact in the range of about $1 million, $1.5 million on a daily basis.
Thank you. By the way, that's fascinating, the language of missed calls. I had no idea about this. I really think we need to tell the people at the U.S. State Department, because they may be misinterpreting this communication. Maybe this is the problem of U.S. foreign policy. Who knows? So I'd like to throw out a question to all of the panel, and any one of you who wants to jump in can do so. So we've discussed the opportunities, we've discussed some of the barriers, we talked about the legal, policy, and regulatory challenges, we mentioned cultural problems, literacy issues. What are your concrete suggestions on how we can overcome some of these barriers? Anyone who wants to jump in, feel free to do so.
So maybe I could just give a really concrete example, talking about, merging this hardware and the software, and going back to what Nancy said about using mobile money. In many cases, as we were talking about, mobile money requires that you can kind of type in your phone number, or you can type in a PIN number and then remember your PIN number. And also, in court, requires that you go through kind of a series of menus or a series of steps. And if you don't know how to do it, then you have to ask someone else to help you and show it to you, or you are dependent upon the agent who you might or might not trust. And if you go into a lot of, at least in my experience in sub-Saharan Africa, if you look at kind of the information that's out there about mobile money, it's maybe a poster or a very tiny pamphlet that's written in English in about 9-point font that takes me about an hour to understand what's happening. And, if I just want to send mobile money in some countries, I actually have to physically type in the telephone number twice. I can't actually go to my contacts and pull up my contact. So then put yourself in the context of someone who doesn't necessarily know how to read or recognize letters and numbers, and they're not necessarily sure how much they actually want to send. What are some simple, concrete things that you could do? And this gets back to the business model. So a concrete thing that you potentially could do and that we've done in Niger and Ghana is simply have kind of a large-scale poster of a mobile phone that's laminated that's in the village. Everyone can look at, you can see where the numbers are, you can choose your own PIN number, and then if you want someone to show you how to go through the process, they can show you how to go through the process, and it's constantly there as a reference. And then on the other side of that, it just basically goes through the four or five steps for using mobile money. It sounds incredibly simple. It sounds as if it wouldn't actually work. It does seem to work in some of the research that we've done. Now, the question here is really, who's going to pay for it? Is it going to be the public sector or the private sector? And so as Nancy said, right now, maybe some of the mobile phone operators don't necessarily see kind of the margins or the revenues that they need to make that investment to actually do this. And so could you have a model where maybe the public sector, whether that's going to be a government or an NGO or whomever, might be paying for that at the beginning to see what works and what doesn't work? And if we find out that some of these very simple kind of educational or informational tools work, then that could be something that could be incorporated into the model of the private sector for the longer term. So just a quick thought.
Okay, so you would argue public education is really vital to this. Other thoughts? Nancy?
Sort of picking up on that theme, let me just mention three things to, as sort of the wedges to kind of accelerate the progress. I think financial literacy beyond, you know, taking what Jenny was saying, but going beyond that, we're finding is really important to identify to the user the benefits of not operating in cash, and having savings accounts. So I would say one key thing is to focus on savings as well as payments, because payments are hugely useful. But I think we miss an opportunity if we don't work savings accounts into the provision of financial services. And you do really have to explicitly provide education in order to increase the demand for the product. And I'll just give you a very specific example that I have heard of. This is not actually a myth program, but this is a program to sit down with people receiving remittances in a bank and cashing out those remittances. And it's a program to provide them 20 minutes of education on financial services and the benefits of keeping that remittance in an account in the bank and savings. And it has an enormous impact in terms of demand for savings products. So 20 minutes of education in and of itself has been very impactful. The second thing is, as I was mentioning before, start where the flows are already happening. When you know you have these conditional cash transfer flows, you know they're regular flows, you know they're big, use that to drive progress. Same thing with remittances. So you can provide confidence to the actors in the chain that there's going to be regular flow and some predictability of that flow. The third thing I would say is what the development institutions and the public sector can do is try to promote platforms which have access from multiple providers. So try to create platforms which multiple mobile phone providers have access to, and also provide access to multiple financial institutions to the platforms, because that's the way you get to scale. And I think that's a kind of a role that the public sector can play, public regulators can play, in kind of solving the collective action program, collective action challenge of any individual mobile provider and bank not wanting to have other actors in the space.
Okay, Carlos, your ideas on overcoming barriers?
I'd like to study the case for M-Pesa in Kenya. I know it was government-backed, but it definitely boomed without that much support. So I was wondering, well, I was hearing your remarks of, yes, I'm sure these things would help, but could it possibly grow organically? But maybe Kenya was just a one-off. Because indeed, there's so many initiatives going on right now that have not succeeded. And I'm also very curious because the more mobile money that it is, the easier it is to reach people.
But I think that just really briefly going back, what I understand happened in Kenya and where they got it right is that they got their agent network right. So, you know, you need agents to cash in and cash out. If you invest in that agent network, people are near an agent, you don't know how to use it, you can help me. If you don't have an agent network and you have to walk an hour in order to get an agent, then it becomes much less useful and you don't have a relationship with that person. So I think that I agree. I would love to know what happened. My understanding is I think that that agent network might have been extremely important.
Because one interesting situation that just started 2 weeks ago is one of the largest phone companies in Central America reached out to Kiva saying, hey, we would like to work with you guys to provide mobile money and provide loans to our users. And it was the question of, well, why doesn't the private sector just start doing it? Mm. And from the Kiva side, it's like, well, you're a multi-billion dollar company. Why are you asking Kiva money, right? Like, where do we play a role? And it's more of a question of shareholders probably cannot take that risk. It's irresponsible for them to go into these areas when there's nothing quantified. And perhaps, and this is not yet determined, Kiva can play a role with such large corporates to help them prove that indeed there is a profitable business model that they can follow in that space and help that trigger mobile money throughout Central America.
So, Nancy, you wanted to jump in, then we'll hear about the Indian case again.
Sure. Two other things about M-Pesa that, according to my understanding, they were practically a monopoly mobile service provider. So that meant that once you were in the Safaricom service provider network, not only did you have cash in, cash out, a lot of options, but also once you created the payment system, everybody was on the same payment system. Essentially, it was the Safaricom payment system, so you were a part of the Safaricom network, and therefore it maximized your opportunity to transfer money to somebody on the other side of the country and also to pay for something. So there were advantages of being a prime mover and a monopoly in the Safaricom case, which don't exist in other, they don't really exist in Central America. So we need to find a way to do it when there are multiple mobile service providers. And the other thing is regulation. In the Kenya case, the Kenyan regulatory authorities allowed the system to grow organically, unregulated, essentially, in order to sort of do the experiment to see if it worked. And it worked very well. And at least in the beginning, I'm not sure now, those accounts on M-Pesa were not linked to a bank account. In most of Latin America, the regulators want the accounts. If it's a store of value, it needs to be linked to a bank account so that it introduces more stability and protection in the system. On the other hand, it limits experimentation more.
So can you give us advice based on the Indian case in terms of what you think would be most impactful to overcoming some of the barriers we've talked about?
In ECHO, the way we define it is five things need to get checked. One is infrastructure and connectivity with the financial systems. The second is product and pricing. And product and pricing in the Indian context is important because we have a bank-led model, so the product and the pricing is of the banks. The third is unit economics, which is for the banks, for us, and for the end agent. Fourth is awareness. And fifth, which is very, very important, is timely payment of commission. And if all the five boxes get checked for us, that's when we see and we have seen that it is a lot easier to scale. And regulation plays a very important role in ensuring that all the five boxes get checked over a period of time. It's a very nice way of saying that the regulator in Kenya allowed for it. Probably the regulator in Kenya was not even aware of what was happening. That is good. Regulations, absolutely, and in India we face this, are very, very sector specific, and now there is a lot of push for regulations to become principle based. One can understand the perspective of the regulator. They are very, very concerned about the end consumer and their deposits, and which is what the other regulators are waking up to And that is why they're pushing for a lot of bank-led model. But the answer may not lie in it being a bank-led or a mobile network operator-led model. If the regulations move from being sector-specific to being principle-based, then one can allow for 1,000 flowers to bloom. And you could have very strong guidelines around consumer protection for it to support. And that's important. The other thing is the role of the mobile network operator. They're the infrastructure provider. Now, when it comes to value-added services over mobile phones, they have gone ahead and partnered with a lot of companies. And they have allowed them to put applications onto their platform. But as far as mobile money is concerned, they have a very different take. They want to do it on their own. And it's probably time for MNOs across the globe to learn a lot from platforms such as Facebook and open it up. Open it up for a lot of players like Kiva, Echo, and many more across globally to access their network, because they are sitting on some amazing, not only have they extended great infrastructure, they're sitting on amazing data. Because just from the calling patterns, one can identify the remittance corridors. The behavior of those corridors, the behavior of customers, the movement of customers in those corridors, they're sitting on rich data. And if they can open up their network, then a lot of mobile money players can access that data and provide fantastic services for the end consumer.
Okay, thank you. Let's open the floor to any questions or comments from the audience. We have one back there. There's a microphone that will come over to you. And if you can give us your name and your organization, and we'd ask you to keep your questions brief just so we can get to as many people as possible. Thank you. Yeah, it should be on.
The answer is yes. I mean, we are trying, but obviously we need to have the collaboration from the phone company. And in this particular discussion, that was considered. I was just being able to access Kiva Capital does not mean that we're able to identify who's the proper credit. And the company just mentioned that there are building models by looking at a consumer's use of a prepaid card, of how often it's filled, they can actually determine what their net income is. And, I mean, that extrapolation is fascinating, but that data is not with Kiva. It's with the phone company, and it's not public access. I would be surprised if, I mean, Abhishek mentioned it. They have it. They're sitting on the data, but it's not an open network, so nobody can access it. So it does exist not only for phone companies, but for any service that you're regularly paying, the data is sitting there. But we do not have access to it.
Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting question. There are all kinds of models sort of springing up now where you use patterns of social network use, for example. Not even payment records, but you can predict somebody's creditworthiness, or at least this is the claim, from social network use, patterns of social networks, who you communicate with. So there's that kind of model. There are also social networks being created, and it's somewhat like the Kiva model, where you have a network of people that are prepared to vouch for each other for credit. So you essentially apply for credit to the network, and you get the credit, and there are others in the network that vouch for you. So it's using the power of networks, essentially, to either create security of repayment by having it's almost like a village banking concept, but it's a social, but through a social network, or you sort of identify patterns of social networking, and then you predict somebody's behavior, including whether they're going to pay back a loan. So these are all new models that are kind of stringing up.
Okay, there's another hand up. Yeah, right there.
Hi, my name is Julia Clark. I work at the Center for Global Development on the use of biometric identification technology in development. And listening to this conversation, one of the things we talked a little bit about the advantages of multilaterals, other big donors, in funding projects to begin where they're very expensive, in establishing common platforms. And one of the themes in our work is that we see these occasions where donors do have an advantage and can have a positive role. In other cases, they seem to be pushing technology for technology's sake as a fad. So I was wondering if, in addition to those two things, you could talk more about how can donors really be helpful in harnessing the technology, and where have they been problematic, perhaps?
Jenny or Nancy?
You can start. Go ahead.
With respect to biometrics in particular, there's obviously a huge power of creating financial identities, creating identities, period, through biometrics, which can then solve some of the problem of knowing your customer for a financial institution. So so I think at this stage, we know certainly in India of a major experiment in biometrics, but I think that's government-led, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
You could imagine biometric experiments that are private sector-led or even financial institution-led, but then they wouldn't be public goods. The financial institution might restrict access to that biometric identity data. So this to me is a question. It's very complicated for governments, and it's also complicated for a donor organization like mine. My organization generally deals with the private sector, not the public sector, in our sort of development interventions. So I was just having a conversation this morning with a major payments service provider who was thinking about a biometric test for use of their debit cards. And it's a question for us whether that's something appropriate for the private sector to do, or should we really start from the notion that the public sector has to decide, has to run those financial or biometric identity systems to keep it as a public good, with accountability for how that identity system is used, because you can imagine very bad misuse of that kind of identity. So we're just grappling with these problems now, and I hope CGD. I'd love for CGD to work on kind of what kinds of principles we should think about it and apply in that context.
So you came here to ask a question, and we gave you an assignment.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Oh, good.
Great. Sounds good. Jenny.
So I think your question is really important, and I also want to just highlight that it is not just specific to mobile phones. I mean, I think we can go back 15 years ago and think about if any of you have seen projects where computers were placed in schools that had no electricity. You're thinking, who had the brilliant idea to do this? And there was no generator, and there was no solar panel. So, there's always going to be these issues. But maybe just two things that I think are quite important that aren't specific to biometrics. Number one, I think that piloting is crucial in this idea of a proof of concept. And I don't mean a proof of concept like you have an app and then you go out and you test the app and you see if the platform works for these particular mobile phones. I mean, again, what's the interaction between that app or that particular technology and the way in which people are using it? Are people actually using your technology, and how are they using their technology, and what difficulties are they having, and what's the scale that you actually have? I think that that's really crucial. It doesn't need to be a 2-year-long RCT. It could literally be what we're calling like pre-search, preliminary research, where over a course of 4 or 5 months, if you're in 10 or 12 locations, you can learn a lot. I think that can be very useful, and it's not very expensive. The second thing that I think would be important is to think about, you know, are there certain applications that we think are useful but might not necessarily fit into a normal business model because they're going to be a quasi-public good? You know, so guiding access to price information or health information, people might be willing to pay for that service, but it also may be the case that one person in the village pays for the service and then shares it with everyone else in the village, which is the most efficient way to do it. But from a private sector perspective, that's not going to get the subscriptions and the scale that you need to make this a sustainable business model. And so this is a case where, again, you could see that kind of the donor investment could be quite useful. And then the question is, could other things be added onto that platform that are going to provide value added that people might be willing to pay for?
Okay. There's a, right there on the aisle.
Hi, I'm Gayatri from Intermedia. I have a question for Abhishek. How does ECHO incentivize people to, especially bottom of pyramid, urban migrants to move from informal services like Tatkals, et cetera, towards more formal services like ECHO? And how do you get around issues of minimum balance in a bank account or a form of identity that many urban BOP workers might not have? So how do they access ECHO? Thanks.
Sure. Awareness is a big challenge. So one of the fundamental learning for us was that when people keep money under the mattress, they actually keep it for the control of it. Mm-hmm. Because money under the mattress is always available. But and hence, it was extremely important for us to communicate that money in the bank was also 24/7 available. Or 24/7, it was under your control. And the most popular service for us was the balance check. You know, people would, when they would put money, they would start with a rupee or 2 rupee, very small amounts, and they would do a lot of balance check inquiries. And balance check would happen in the middle of the night to check if everything was there. We have not been able to solve this problem of accessing that money 24/7. Because our service is available when the shop opens, so say 6, 7 in the morning, to say about 11 in the evening. But what happens if there is an emergency and somebody wants cash? It has taken a lot of time for the banks to understand that this alternate channel needs to be integrated with the mainstream channels, existing mainstream channels. But still not there. Customers have the understanding of what is formal and what is informal. They make the choice for formal. Today, there isn't availability of formal instruments. Or the reason why money lenders are prevalent is because loan is 24/7 available. We may see them as sharks, but they see them as people who are going to help them in the time of the need. So customers have this understanding of what is informal and what is formal. As far as we are concerned, how do we drive usage? Well, the trick for us was that, and we realized that that the customer must do at least 3 transactions within 30 days of opening a bank account. If they will do 3 transactions, because in our case, it was usage of cell phone, and we have a very interesting piece of paper device. It's a paper-based RSA device for securing the transactions.
So this is a multimedia presentation on your part.
So this fits in the same slot as your cards. And this is a one-time password generator. It's a paper-based booklet. This is what helps us secure the transactions on a cell phone. So we had to get them to use this at least 3 times. If they use it 3 times in the first 30 days, then we have seen that people use it. One very important thing which drives usage is pricing. Initially, the banks did not have a model, and everything was free of cost for the customers. So there was a lot of usage. Then they suddenly realize that it needs to be a self-sustainable model, and nobody should self-sustain itself. So without really getting into the understanding of how this should work, they started to charge for every transaction, including deposits and withdrawals. Well, that's not true for us. Our charges, the more we save in the bank, the more free transactions we get. But there was no incentive to save now. So we have seen initially there was a lot of usage and a lot of accounts being opened, and that has come down significantly because of this skewness in pricing. For money transfer, it works all across. So the money transfer has gained a lot of traction.
Okay. Other questions? Alan?
Alan Friedman from Brookings. So one of the things that's come up when we look at information communication technologies is not just the regulatory question, but the political question. There are some regimes that, shall we say, really prioritize stability, we'll call it that, and thus often attempt to either are afraid of ICT or attempt to impose very strong controls. We've seen this a lot in the internet sphere, and in fact it's a priority of the Secretary of State. Is this something that you think we need to worry about in mobile, or do you think that it's either flown under the radar or it exists purely in an economic state and thus doesn't pose any risk to regimes that are worried about collective action that isn't state-sanctioned?
Well, in India, this used to be a problem early on, but cell phone and the reason why cell phones really scaled up or information technology as a sector in India has scaled up because it had least intervention from the government. And now it has spread so much that you know, you can't reverse it. A similar change needs to happen in financial services, because the moment financial services gets attached to terms like low income, it becomes very dangerous. You know, then the government in power wants to dole out subsidies wherever it is not required, and all kinds of things start to happen which do not comply to a business model. It's not that subsidies are not important. It's important for people who are not economically active. As far as cell phones are concerned, nobody created subsidies. You know, it's an infrastructure which has spread across the country because it made economic sense to do it and because people were more than willing to pay for it. And the tool eventually has empowered them enough. So a basic bank account, I believe, is an equally empowering tool. So if the government starts to not interfere so much, I think it'll do great.
At least in most of Latin America, with I guess one glaring exception, the government doesn't intervene, doesn't actually censor internet usage. However, your question does raise some sort of interesting issues about information availability as a public good, because you know in the banking sector, people create credit bureaus as a public good. It's both a private good and a public good. It's good for the institutions that participate in the credit bureau because they share information about creditworthiness, but it's also a public good because it actually tends to overall raise credit access. At the moment, we don't really have any kind of modalities and sort of customary practice with respect to sharing information by mobile providers. So this is something I think increasingly that will come to the fore, that you have to that information will be increasingly useful as the services provided by the mobile providers expands. People will want to know more and more about patterns of those services, and that there will be a public interest in sharing that information, and that the mobile providers will have a proprietary interest in not sharing the information. So I think it's really important. I think that's another subject that we're going to have to grapple with over time, and particularly publicly funded institutions.
I was wondering if the panel could address the particular issue of women in this topic and what you see, because in a lot of places it seems like women have challenges in terms of gaining access to capital and getting access to some of the things we're talking about. So I'm just curious your views on how many of these developments actually will help women in particular, if at all.
Right. I think it's extremely dependent on the country, and even within countries, it's extremely dependent on cultural behaviors. I mean, we've done some work in Niger, in two different areas of Niger with two different ethnic groups, one using a mobile phone education kind of program and the other one using the mobile phone as a transfer device. And in both cases, women learned equally as effectively as men. But in one of the cases with one particular group, they learned much more and they were able to transfer that knowledge into kind of changes in behavior, such as going to the market and negotiating for higher prices, which wasn't necessarily the case in the other environment. When we look at the kind of the using the mobile money as a cash transfer device, in some of the work that we've done, receiving your cash transfer via the mobile phone actually seemed to change intra-household bargaining in the sense that rather than having someone come and everyone observe that you got an envelope full of cash, which if I were to do that in my family, my brother and someone would say, hey, okay, can you just give me, $50? Well, this is what was happening in this case. But when it was via the mobile phone, it was a discreet beep that only the woman of the household knew about. And she informed us that she still talked about it with her husband, but she talked about it with her husband at another time when it was just the two of them and they were able to make decisions together about how to actually spend that money. But if we were to do that in another part of even Niger, it's not necessarily clear that we would find the exact same results. So I think that issues of intra-household dynamics and gender are things that are extremely complex. And getting back to what I had said previously, the research that we have, I think, is really excellent. But there's some of these cases where it's going to be very difficult for us to make kind of blanket statements about how technology is going to be affecting people. In some cases, we think that it could actually make the situation better. In other cases, you could actually imagine where it could make the situation worse. If you go back to microfinance, there are always kind of anecdotal stories about the fact that if the credit was provided to the woman and if other members of the household weren't informed, this created a bit of tension within the household because it was really changing power within the household. And so how do you ensure that the household overall is being informed, not just one individual?
Just to add a couple of things to that. There's certainly evidence that having a mobile channel to receive services helps people who have less mobility. And women, in many instances, have less mobility to go to certainly a formal bank branch or to travel long distances. There's also a security issue, obviously, that there's, in a lot of the research, if you can execute payments without having to carry cash around, that's important for everybody, but maybe particularly for women. And then the other thing is, again, piggybacking on what Jenny was saying, there is some evidence that if women can save more formally, their savings rates actually increase. And so that can be, there are different ways to save formally, but if the mobile phone helps you save formally through using this channel, and it therefore raises women's formal savings rates, it can do a lot of things in terms of how they allocate those savings, in terms of responding to shocks, and even starting businesses, which we in particular are interested in, helping women raise savings rates in order to be able to start and grow businesses.
Okay, there's a gentleman over by the window who has a question. Yes. Yeah, there's a microphone coming over to you.
Hello, my name is Sinan Beyeton. I'm a technologist, and I work mainly in West Africa. On the question that the gentleman asked, I think there, especially in the area where I work, government is having more and more intervention. If you follow the elections, for example, in Côte d'Ivoire or even in Kenya, I think, when you shut off SMS and your whole monitoring system is based on SMS reporting and crowdsourcing, you have a problem. Also working with app developers and trying to develop applications for anything that has to do with finance has to go through the central bank, Banque Centrale des États de l'Afrique de l'Ouest. So depending on the countries, you have actually serious intervention, and it is only going to get worse if no one says anything. But we were actually, I just came from a meeting. I'm with Véron Mankou. I don't know if you know him, but he is actually a Congolese who his company, VMK, designed the first African smartphone, African tablet. And so I'd like to know from your point of view, what is the place, if any, for devices coming from the South as a solution for some of the things we're talking about? Thank you.
Okay, good question. Devices from the South.
Well, I think, I mean, if you look at a lot of the innovation, it seems to be, if you look at M-Pesa, you know, one of the reasons for mobile money transfers was because they were observing that people were transferring airtime. And people took that observation and they said, how can we make this into kind of a sustainable business venture? And I think that, you know, there's a lot that's going on within sub-Saharan Africa. The question, I guess there's maybe two questions, and you guys would know better than I would, but number one is that how do you get financing for that? And number two, how do you get exposure and getting people to know about it, not only within your country, you know, such as Congo, but other places within sub-Saharan Africa? So there's going to be exchanges that are happening, and there's going to be kind of trade that's happening so that people are aware of these devices. And so I think if those two things could be facilitated, and I don't know exactly how to facilitate them, maybe one is through Kiva, that could be kind of, I think, huge, right? Because there are so many interesting applications and ideas, Ushahidi, for example, that arose after the Kenyan election of 2008, things that are happening all throughout the continent. But I think what seems to be kind of one of the barriers is, ironically enough, is sharing that information across Francophone and Lusophone and Anglophone Africa. And then once that information is shared, how can those products actually be introduced and traded so that there's a market for it and something that's supported?
Okay. Right there on the aisle. So, woman with a question. Yep.
Hi, I'm Sahara Saad. I'm a PhD student at George Washington University. My question is to Professor Aker. You'd mentioned about the enabling environment and how markets working efficiently, but then when the enabling environment is not there, what are the sort of, in the long run, the consequences and how bad are, I mean, the losers, how bad are the losers? Thanks.
So unfortunately, I think as researchers, we often focus on, you know, this partial equilibrium. If we give a technology to farmers, what happens to those farmers? And then we don't see what happens to the poorer farmers, what might happen to the traders, what might happen to people who are living in other areas. I think that that's a fault and a shortcoming of our own work. I think, you know, the broader thing that I wanted to say is that, number one, if we could do research that helps us to look at that general equilibrium, it would be great, but it's going to be very difficult to do. Number two, though, as we're thinking about policy, as we're thinking about the private sector and the public sector, and maybe since I focus on the public sector, that's where my kind of knowledge is, that we have to realize that, you know, if we're introducing a certain type of technology, we're just affecting one part of the system and not the entire system. And so we need to understand about those elements of the entire system to understand why kind of our technology might or might not be having the effect that we think it's actually going to have. And going back to the previous example from the woman from CGD, I think that this idea of kind of piloting interventions to start off can be extremely useful. And then this idea of doing, I think, kind of innovative research in order to really understand the impact can help us to move forward, not just in one context, but in multiple contexts. Because one of the weaknesses, I would say, in academia is that, you know, once we've studied something in one country, it's like, that's it. Then it works everywhere, which we know is not going to be, you know, the case. And so if we can really foster that and facilitate that learning across a multitude of contexts, qualitative and quantitative, I think that we can start to get a body of evidence.
I knew as an economist, Jenny would not be able to go through this session without talking about partial equilibriums. Fred has a question right here on the aisle.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman. I've got one observation and a really naive question. The observation is you haven't been around long enough because in the States, college students used to use ring communication to parents, say, to get, we arrived safely, or I can't remember what the other things were, but it actually did occur here. The other thing is being totally uninformed about how this works. At $1.25 a day in this country, there would be very little need for cash transfers and even less for savings. What does this mean in Africa or other countries where $1.25 is something you could actually live on?
The $1.25 is an average. It's actually, you have very lumpy payments because you're usually in the informal sector, so you don't know when you're actually going to get your cash flow. And precisely because of that, saving is like so fundamental. It's probably more important than the access to credit. And that's why it's so important that you once you get the money, what you do with it. And if it's just stacking it under your bed, I mean, it's not as good as it could be. So I think that should answer the 125. But
I mean, there's a famous book I'm sure many of you know called Portfolios of the Poor, and it addressed precisely that question. Do the poor actually need financial services and use financial services? And it turned out, and this is a book where the authors essentially had individuals keep financial diaries. And it turns out they use a lot of financial services. They use them, you know, a lot per year, and they use them repeatedly. And they use all, you know, they use savings, they use payments, and they use, you know, various kinds of insurance precisely because their income is, they need to smooth their consumption because, you know, the financial products essentially allow them to deal with the rising and falling income. The other thing I would just say is that in Latin America in particular, the people who make, say, $4 a day or less, which are considered kind of poor in Latin America, account for 30% of the population, so it's a big group. The people who make $4 to $10 a day account for nearly 40% of the population. And they're a group that has been characterized as vulnerable and is sort of statistically at higher risk of falling back into poverty. And so, and they're a group that very much needs financial services in their household transactions, but also in their businesses. So, at least in Latin America and the Caribbean, we're really talking about, you know, two-thirds of the population in terms of targeting these services.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question, so we'll go right here. So we have a microphone coming over. So this means it has to be a really good question.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't know. Hopefully this will live up to it. My name is Trang Pham, and I'm a technology and management consultant working in the international development sector. And I know a lot of our conversation has been focused on, you know, very basic cell phones, voice and SMS data service. I'd be curious to know what your thoughts are on, you know, the smartphone, especially since a lot of developing countries are rolling out 4G. Like, what examples do you see out there for smartphone features and functions, like even like the video functions, to be able to drive economic development, and for what profile of entrepreneur?
Yes, smartphones, at least I can talk about India. And as an organization, we have started to look into this. People have already figured out to a great extent how to handle a smartphone, especially for entertainment purposes. Music videos, movie trailers, pirated stuff. A lot of smartphones are already being used. One very critical thing is, and if you remove the dust from the surface, is the design which gets people to intuitively adopt. So it's the design of the player. So while smartphones are there, smartphones also bring along lot of navigation. And if the design isn't good, people can't figure it out. And we have seen this. So one of the things which attracts us to a smartphone is because a lot can be done on a smartphone. The video can be used. But the challenges which you are facing is that even when Android is one singular platform, it starts to behave differently on different form factors of screen, and that's a challenge. So it is all about design. If you get the design correct for financial services or for anything, you can get people to adopt smartphones, because smartphones are going to get into everybody's hands eventually.
Carlos?
Yeah. In the case of the interventions I mentioned, two were actually smartphones, and one was actually a tablet. So the way I look at it is, we in developed industrialized countries, we probably use smartphones as a form of convenience, but it can be used as a productive device. And once it becomes a productive device, it's a type of investment that will generate you a greater income. That's when it will be much more attractive for particularly BOP consumers, because it will enable them to increase their income, which is what's happening with all the products that keep us financing. Like, we are financing a smartphone so that their increased income can increase, and they, through that increased income, can pay back that smartphone. And I think that's the leap between 2G phones and a smartphone.
Okay, I want to thank Jenny, Nancy, Carlos, and Abhishek for sharing their views with us, and thank you very much for coming out as well.
Thank you.